Hello and welcome to the iFeatures podcast. This is the second episode in our second series, Stories About Place. We have a brand new round of iFeatures projects embarking on their development journeys, and we'll be hearing from those teams, as well as others from previous rounds of the programme, all about their films and how the places they are either set or filmed in contribute to the stories they are telling. Last time out, we visited Bristol, the birthplace of iFeatures and home to some exciting new projects currently in development. Now though, we are heading across to the other side of the capital to explore England's southeast regions. From the colourful past of Crystal Palace.
Even at the beginning of the 19th century, this was a really kind of magical place for lots of people in London, where you would go and you would have your fortune read by fortune tellers, or you would go and be robbed by highwaymen. It was kind of this really kind of like out there place.
To the eclectic coastline of Kent.
It has that wonderful mix between sort of, I don't know, traditional seaside and sort of modern, funky, art-influenced stuff with the Turner Gallery in Margate and cool new businesses and Dreamland, which is really fab.
Today, we are heading to the seaside town of Deal, where Gabrielle Lindemann of the Kent Film Office will talk us through the area's filming hotspots, some of the logistics of filming on location, and even sneak us onto the set of a film currently in production. We'll also be hearing from Fred and Sabina, who are the team behind one of this year's 12 iFeatures projects, titled Phil and Ian, which is set in present-day Crystal Palace. They, along with the other teams on this year's programme, were recently all down in the southeast attending their next iFeatures development lab at the London Film Festival. And as if that wasn't exciting enough for everyone involved in iFeatures, this year's London Film Festival hosted the premieres of not one but two films developed on previous rounds of iFeatures, Perfect 10 and Makeup. Right now, though, for this year's filmmakers, thoughts of strutting down the red carpet are firmly on hold. And for one of the teams, it's instead a stroll through the streets of Crystal Palace, as they tell us about their project currently in development on this year's iFeatures.
So my name is Fred Rosen, and I am the writer-director of Phil and Ian.
And I'm Sabina Smitham, and I'm the producer of it.
So Phil and Ian is the story of a couple, Phil and Ian, who've been together for about 30 years. And when our film begins, they have kind of reached a breaking point in their relationship at which they are both, they kind of, neither of them can admit to themselves that, you know, they need to either change radically or their relationship is going to end. And before they can kind of confront that question head on, they're abducted by aliens.
Yeah, exactly. And so throughout their relationship, what's been their dynamic is that Phil has been sort of selfish and a bit of a leech and always needed to be the special one. And gradually he's eaten away at this relationship, but he has no idea about that. So what he needs to do once Ian's been abducted by this alien is he needs to try and get Ian back, basically. But in order to do that, he needs to have some big realizations about what he's done, how their relationship has suffered, what the reality of their relationship is now, and realize the fact that he doesn't know Ian at all. And long before Ian was abducted by an alien, he was already alien to Phil anyway.
In these early stages of development, it can often be the place that is the driving force behind some of the decisions on the tone, voice, and feel of a film. Joining Fred and Sabina was Creative England's Abby Brennan, who had asked them to guide her through some of the areas of Crystal Palace that have provided much of the inspiration for their film.
So where are you taking us today?
Okay, so well, right now we're walking along Annerley Road.
Yeah.
Up towards Crystal Palace.
Would Phil and Ian walk up this road?
I mean, I think they probably live on this road.
Okay, wow.
I mean, the interesting thing about this road that we're walking along, and you'll kind of see it a little bit more as we get further along, is that on one side of the street, you've got these kind of Victorian suburban houses. that were sort of built in order to, you know, people could come and live here and then get the train into central London. All of this entire area is kind of crisscrossed by train tracks that were built by the Victorians. But it's almost like at this point, the Victorian project kind of stops. And then on the other side of the road, you've got like proper British suburbia that doesn't really feel like London.
Okay.
And so you're on this kind of interesting borderline where the people living on one side of the street could kind of say, oh yeah, I'm, you know, I live in London and I go and work in town every day and I'm kind of quite metropolitan. And then on the other side of the street, you've got what you might imagine as more of a sort of traditional cul-de-sacs and privet hedges and that kind of thing. And Phil and Ian are interestingly kind of caught in this divide.
It's like a fault line between tectonic plates or something.
Exactly.
A place where like weird things can happen.
Exactly. Exactly. It's that sort of netherworld between the two. And the big idea with Phil and Ian, they're these two guys who sort of feel like their best days are behind them. And what lies ahead is kind of the end of their life and or both of their lives in the near or in the imaginable future. Okay. And the interesting thing about being here is, you know, they're at a point where they're asking themselves, well, who are we? Who do we want to be? And this kind of area seems to always be asking itself the same thing. You know, is it this side of the street or is it that side of the street?
So tell me a little bit about where Phil and Ian were born. I mean, in your brain, not actually the characters.
Which hospital, well, specifically?
Well, one of them, Ian, is from Crystal Palace.
Okay.
And kind of grew up in South London. And then another of them, Phil, I think, grew up outside of London and in the countryside and kind of came to London with this idea of how glamorous it could be.
Okay.
Right? And so when he finds himself 40 years later, kind of like clinging by his fingernails to the edges of London suburbia, he kind of justifiably goes, well, what happened there? You know, and if I let go, I'm going to be like tumbling back into the slightly sort of parochial world that I came from.
So tell me a little bit about why you were so keen to set it in Crystal Palace. You obviously grew up around here.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up a little bit further north from here. So Crystal Palace is somewhere that I've kind of come to, but I've never lived. But it feels really right, partly for the reasons that we were talking about in terms of this kind of area that kind of can't decide what it is. But I mean, Crystal Palace seems like this slightly magical place. Like you'll notice we're walking up a lot of hills. And I mean, also, if you look at the names of the street, like Thicket Terrace, Thicket Road, this entire area used to be a kind of woodland forest in the Middle Ages and before. And then slowly over, you know, hundreds of years, that was chopped down and fenced off. And now you've got these tiny little pockets of woodland like Dulwich Woods and Sydenham Woods that are still the kind of remainder of that forest. But it feels like even at the beginning of the 19th century, this is a really kind of magical place for lots of people in London, where you would go and you would have your fortune read by fortune tellers, or you would go and be robbed by highwaymen. It was kind of this really kind of like out there place. And it's really interesting how it has become somewhere that feels quite suburban, but then actually, you know, it's called Crystal Palace because it had the Crystal Palace built, relocated here from Hyde Park in the 19th century, which then also burnt down. So it's like, again and again, there have been these kind of magical, interesting things about Crystal Palace that have just sort of crumbled, which feels like a really nice metaphor for their relationship.
I really like that.
And equally, you then have these strange kind of urban legends around here. Like, there's this thing called the Sydenham Panther, which every sort of 5 to 10 years, there'll be these news reports of a giant cat that has been sighted around this area, which is kind of, and it's kind of quite well documented. Like it's reported in all the local papers, but it's reported in The Guardian and The Daily Mail and stuff like that as well. And the idea is that there's this big cat that uses the railway lines to kind of travel between different places, and it'll break into someone's garden and eat their, you know, eat their rabbits and things like that. So it feels like there is just this sense of like another world just intruding on our own in this part of London.
So in a way, it feels a bit like the idea of an alien choosing somebody in Crystal Palace to take over their body doesn't feel that far-fetched. You
know, exactly.
It is, but it isn't.
So this actually sounds quite a bit like your short that you made. Yeah, so I assume you've borrowed a little bit from there. And
yeah, totally. I mean, like Sabina says, it feels like all of that could take place just down the road from here.
Yeah.
You know, but this is a kind of epicentre of that strange type of activity. And as we're going to see when we look at some parts of Crystal Palace Park, it feels like the past weighs really heavily on this area, and it feels like it's somewhere that is still sort of trying to recover from this legacy of having been an amazing place.
So tell me a little bit about, we'll start with you, Fred. Tell me a little bit about your background. How did you get into filmmaking, and how did you know this is exactly what I need to be doing and these are the stories that I need to be telling?
I mean, I since I was a teenager, I wanted to tell stories and to make films, and my earliest films did have a kind of similar theme of slightly magical things happening in, you know, kind of in the places that were most easily accessible to me, like Lewisham, where I grew up. So, you know, my first film when I was 16 was about a guy who thought Bigfoot lived in his local park, and it was like a fake documentary about that. And so that's always kind of what's driven me, is like the sort of crossover between the magical and the mundane. Okay. And telling stories about those people who kind of become obsessed by that. So that's kind of what I've chipped away at, is writing stories like that and trying to tell those stories.
And what about you, Sabina?
Well, I just think I somehow always knew that this is all that I wanted to do. I was thinking while Fred was talking, why did I end up doing film?
Sure, I'd like to know as well.
Yeah, well, I'll see if I can try and make up a reason. No, I mean, I think when I was really little, my dad made me watch a black and white film that was Angels with Dirty Faces, and I was so cynical going into that process. I was like, why would you make me watch that? At that point, my favourite film was The Lion King. And then I watched Angels with Dirty Faces, and I was in floods of tears by the end of it. And I think that experience has sort of just stuck with me since then, that film is moving in a way that, for me, like other mediums, books, TV, just doesn't quite manage. And so, yeah, I've always just been drawn to these things that you can do in cinema that you can't do in other mediums. And I think things like with a layer of magic, things where it couldn't be quite possible in our world, or maybe it could, you know, things that make you kind of question.
Cool. So I personally think there's something really British. I don't know if it's the humour element that you're going for with it, but the minute you told me it, I felt like I knew a Fillinian.
Yes, yeah. But that's the thing, and I think that's what I look for when I'm coming up with these characters, because I think writing them, you want to get them into a place where they feel kind of real and independent of you, and they're going to go off and do their own thing. But the first thing maybe that you latch onto is, oh, I think I know them. Do you know what I mean? And then you start telling other people about these characters, these people in your head, and the more people you tell, if you're getting that reaction from everyone else, going, oh yeah, I've met someone like that, then you kind of go, okay, yeah, I'm in a good place here.
So tell me how you guys applied for 8 Features. You know, how much prep did you put in? Is this the first time you'd applied separately or together?
First time we applied together.
Okay.
Yeah, I'd applied a previous year, but we'd been working on filling in together for quite a while before the application came up.
Yeah, probably a year or so.
Yeah, I think so. And it had really taken some big leaps. It'd gone from being a very small kernel of an idea to a whole feature. And it just seemed like the perfect opportunity to push it further.
Yeah, absolutely. And it had gone through quite a few drafts before we sent it in. But yeah, it sort of felt like it had been a perfect sort of time where the application was open, and we had also got it into a place where we felt really confident about showing it to other people.
I think it's also worth saying that it's your first feature as a writer, isn't it?
Yeah.
And as a director, actually. But I think that's why we thought iFeatures was really good for us, because it's not just development funding, it's a hell of a lot of support and time and lots of expert voices sort of guiding you along. And this project, partly because we're first time feature makers, but partly because it's so unique, needs that support.
So what are you guys hoping to get out of the end of the iFeatures development programme?
I mean, ideally we want a sort of a well developed draft of the screenplay that we can start seriously looking at producing.
Just want to make it?
Yeah, we want to make it.
I want you to make it.
The next time I'm here, we need to be here with the film crew.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
So you came scouting here yesterday. So
yes.
You're going to be our tour guide for today.
Yeah.
As we've walked up from the previous station, it's exactly what you guys said about it's very normal, and then the minute you've walked in here, it also, I can feel the magical element that you were talking about. It's like two completely different worlds almost.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, so we're getting to Crystal Palace Park now, which, yeah, was sort of was put here as the site of Crystal Palace. And so, we're, I mean, first of all, we're going to go and look at the famous dinosaurs.
Yay!
And then we're going
to
go
really
and look
looking
at
forward
the,
to the dinosaurs.
The ruins of Crystal Palace.
Amazing.
So let's see, which way are we going? I think we're going to go down here.
And why is Crystal Palace Park so pivotal to the narrative? Why have you chosen here?
Well, this is kind of this is the centre point. I mean, we're not yet at a stage where we're kind of assigning specific locations to specific scenes, but we were sort of talking about this the other day. It feels like, you know, you can't have a film in Crystal Palace without the dinosaurs. So organically, they are going to factor into it. And later you're going to see sort of the site of Crystal Palace and Crystal Palace Parade, and you'll be able to see beyond there to Dulwich Woods, and all of those things are kind of floating around in my head, and I'm sort of thinking, okay, I roughly know, you know, some places more than others where things are going to happen, like I kind of know where the abduction is going to happen, all that kind of thing. But I think it's just kind of interesting for us to walk around here and get the kind of general atmosphere of the area. And I mean, it's interesting walking up Annerley Hill, that feels to me like really sort of pungent in terms of in terms
such
of
a great word thing,
yeah, especially when it's applied to a place, it's a really pungent place. And you can imagine Phil and Ian sort of striding up and down the hill on their way to and from the station.
So you had the first lab last month with all the other iFeatures projects. What was the general response when you first told them your idea?
Well, people laughed, which is good.
Yeah, that was nice. It was a really intense few days. We just had so much feedback, which is such a useful thing. I think generally the response was that people did find it really funny, but also that I think people are quite moved by it.
Yeah.
And that, because it is, I mean, not to give too many spoilers, but it results in quite a sad outcome for Phil especially, and I guess that was quite important to us, that we didn't want to tie everything up in like a really happy bow, because
Hollywood bow.
Exactly, because relationships do come to an end. Sometimes we talk about it in terms of, on this journey of Phil trying to get Ian back from the alien, Phil thinks he's on a mission to get Ian back, but actually he's on a mission to try and let him go.
Right.
And that's kind of where the heartbreak comes. So
exactly.
It should be funny and scary and heartbreaking.
Wow.
Which is a tall order, but I think it's one that we're kind of discovering. We're kind of quite happy with how we're discovering that mixture of tones. And the location has so much to do with, like, as soon as you say, oh, it's set in Crystal Palace, that's already a tone when you're kind of contrasting it with the events that are going on. If you said, oh, we're setting this alien abduction in the middle of nowhere in Arizona, and it's a farmer who's had a crop circle, you kind of go, oh, yeah, I've seen that.
Yeah.
And it's not that funny, you know, or, you know, your knee-jerk reaction isn't to laugh. But I think it's really important, the humorous element, to kind of, it sort of opens people up. It opens your audience up to those kind of slightly more like existential, challenging emotions that we want to be kind of feeding in the second half of the film. Yeah. And if you begin there, you're turning people off. But if you're kind of making them laugh at the start, then you're warming them up for something a bit more complicated.
Yeah, and tenderizing them also for like the scary place, the scary.
Yeah,
parts.
Exactly.
They trust you.
Yeah. And then you just hit them with a really horrific moment. And
yeah.
Destroy all the trust that you've built up. Yeah.
So growing up, when you were both so passionate about film, who were the people that inspired you? What sort of films did you watch and think, I want to make those movies?
It's a really tough question. I mean, when I was really little, the films I loved were like Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers, like musicals. Yeah. Those are the ones that really kind of got me when I was like, you know, when I was 7, 8, 9, 10, like that's what I was going for. And I think in a way, like that's the stuff that I kind of go back to really, really fondly in a really like innocent way, because I can kind of say, oh yeah, you know, I love Martin Scorsese or whatever, but like every time I'm watching those films, I'm watching them from the perspective of a filmmaker, kind of thinking, oh, how's that work and why is, you know, whereas if I go back to those old musicals, I'm just watching them as a viewer.
That is so funny. I don't think I ever knew that about you, but I was just like obsessed with musicals as a kid. I had like Oklahoma and Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, which has a really weird kind of moral message in it, but
the clue's in the title.
Yeah. And yeah, musicals were like a huge thing. I think it's like partly the spectacle of it all, and
yeah, big emotion.
And that they do, this big emotion. They do tend to do like this, like operatic spectacle and big emotion and humour and combining it all. It's, you know, it's such a clever thing.
Just that one question's given so much insight into a visual picture for me of what Phil and Ian's going to actually look like because of both of you liking musicals. I'm not saying it's going to be a musical by any stretch.
No, but that big emotion. Knows? Yeah, but that's really interesting that neither of us is sort of shying away from big emotion.
I think we are all looking forward to seeing how Phil and Ian develops as a project. Now, here on the iFeatures podcast, we're talking to lots of filmmakers making their debut features. And importantly, they are all using regions of the UK as the backdrop to their film. But on an even larger scale, there are also established filmmakers from all over the world, with all kinds of budgets, using the huge array of different locations that the UK regions have to offer. With that in mind, we're heading to the coast now, to the seaside town of Deal in Kent, to be exact, most recently used to film parts of feature biopic Louis Wayne, starring Benedict Cumberbatch. Kent offers an incredibly diverse backdrop for filming. Our tour guide this time is Gabrielle Lindemann from the Kent Film Office, who showed Abby some of the coastline in and around Deal. Needless to say, as you'll hear from parts of the audio, the conditions were a little blustery by the sea.
Thank you so much for inviting us down to Deal in Kent. Over breakfast this morning, you were telling me a little bit about some of the things which you've actually shot here. Can you tell us a little bit more about that now?
Yeah, of course. You were at the Royal, which was basically the set for the last Vanity Fair, and where we had a lot of stuff going on the beach before the soldiers sort of ship in. Deal's also the fictional home of the TV series The Liar, which I've just finished filming their second series. And also recently it features at itself in a Baptiste, which was filming down here. So quite a few thrillers actually, and it's a little, and the tunnel as well.
That's crazy to think when you look at the weather today and you know how serene and peaceful it is, that it's a backdrop for a lot of thrillers.
Yes, I don't know why. Maybe it is that kind of dichotomy between sort of the beautiful outside and the sort of deep, dark things that are underneath.
Going underneath, I love that. Yeah, it's such a beautiful place. Should we have a little look around Kent? You can be our tour guide for today.
Okay, I'll try.
Perfect. Over there, obviously, I can see. Is that the White Cliffs of Dover?
No, that is the White Cliffs, which run sort of more or less along half of the Kent coast. But that is what used to be an island called the Isle of Thanet. It's not an island anymore because the channels have all silted up, and it's now home of Margate, Broadstairs, and Ramsgate. Uh-huh. And they're really traditional seaside towns. And for example, The Lady in the Van recently with Maggie Smith, they came to Broadstairs, and we had Juliet Naked, which was the Nick Hornby adaptation. And they based themselves in Ramsgate and Margate. So we get quite a lot of filming down there because it has that wonderful mix between sort of, I don't know, traditional seaside and sort of modern, funky, art-influenced stuff with the Turner Gallery in Margate and cool new businesses and Dreamland, which is really fab. It's this old, basically a vintage seaside amusement park there.
Okay.
So you get Ferris wheels and dodgems and also lots and lots of arcade games and stuff like that.
Wow. So in the ITV show Liar, is it shot as Kent Deal or is it?
I think it's shot as generic seaside town,
right,
so to speak. But it's mainly the setting of Deal. If you look down there, that is the Marine Parade, and that's where her residence is situated as a location. If you look the other side towards Walmer and Dover, there's a small hamlet called Kingsdown, and that's where her sister's house is. And then there's a lot of stuff that goes on in the streets in and around Deal as well.
So what are residents like in Kent? Do you know, do they welcome filming? Do they get excited by it?
Well, as everywhere, it depends. But I would say for the most, they just love it because Kent is quite a big place and it hasn't really been overfilmed yet. So we are always able to find a nice little pocket where people think, oh God, this is great. And I love what filming sort of brings to the community as well. It's, you know, a film company comes and says, oh, your place is good enough and we love it, and who doesn't kind of like that?
Yeah, totally.
I think the main thing about that is managing it well. If you manage as well and keep the residents informed, they tend to be just really, really welcoming.
Just from driving through Kent, I've only been here probably less than 24 hours and I've seen such a diverse landscape. We were driving through rolling countryside and now we're on a seaside front that in my opinion looks a little bit like Brighton.
That's, I think, one of the main thing about Kent is its diversity. I mean, we've got even the coastline here, so you've got pebble beaches, and if you look into the distance, you can see the white cliffs rising up there.
Yeah, yeah.
A little bit further along towards the Romney Marsh, we've got some the Romney Sands, which is a very large sandy beach with some dunes backing it, and then you go onto this kind of post-apocalyptic place, which is Dungeness, which is basically the one of the biggest shingle deserts in Europe.
Wow.
And sort of there's these kind of used to be old railway shacks, and of course, you know, modern life and grand designs having their influence, so they are now a sort of very unusual, interesting residences that sit there, and they sit in the shadow of a big power station, nuclear power station. Yeah. And it's incredibly popular for filming, and we've just had the Brave New World, the adaptation that's going out with Demi Moore. We just had them there pretending it's America and it's dystopian and it's all that. And that brings its own challenges because, of course, they had a lot of driving sequences and so they drive on the different side of the road. So we have to close the roads and turn all the signs around and all that kind of stuff to make sure that it looks right.
Amazing. So you were telling me there's a production shooting in Kent today.
There is indeed. So and if you have very sharp eyes, you would be able to see them from here. It's sort of about halfway down the coast down there. And this one is a period film. They started off in Botany Bay, which is a really popular beach. It was sort of backed by white cliffs and sand and stacks. And where they did a sort of a driving sequence on top of the cliffs there. Okay. And now they are using one of the local residences, one of the houses, and also various areas of the beach and further on up the cliffs.
Amazing. So you're going to take us down there? And
I'm going to take you down there. I'm going to take you first to Unit Base, and hopefully we'll meet the locations team there.
Okay.
And and then see what we do on our side to make sure that what they want to do is going to happen.
Amazing, let's do it.
Gabrielle and Abby head over to the unit base of the production. This is essentially where all the larger crew vehicles, trucks and trailers are based. It's normally set back a bit from where the actual filming takes place, just due to the sheer size and often noise levels. And it's also where a lot of the logistical issues are often discussed and resolved between the production team and the local film office.
So we're basically here at Unit Base, which is where they do their costume and makeup, and they feed the troops and everybody parks and everything. And I know it doesn't sound terribly glamorous, but it's a really, really important part as the world is getting busier. Big unit bases are really hard to come by. So one of the things we do, which is really, really important, is to work with local councils and landowners to find a lot of unit bases, because obviously a lot of councils think that their car park should be for their residents, and they sometimes get a lot of hassle if they book them out to film to private companies. Yeah. So we try and do a lot of PR with the districts to show them the economic value and the higher cost and etc. And here in the Dover districts it's really well. They have a brilliant parking department and they sort it all out and they cone it off and it's all happening and it's really great. So
So tell us a little bit about what's been going on location here.
So this film, because it's a period film, they have particular special requirements. So for example, outside the house, which is the main location, we had to suspend all the parking in the road. Obviously can't have any modern cars when you look out the window. And we also, they are doing some exterior shots with horses and carriages and antique automobiles. So the surface of the road is obviously wrong. It's modern, it's got lines on it, etc., etc. So what they need to do is they need to close the roads, and they have the road closed now for 2 days, a small section in front of the house, so they can put some road surface down and some sand, etc., etc., so it doesn't look like a tarmacked modern road.
After exploring unit base, it's time to head onto the set.
Hello, how are you doing?
Nice to meet you, Abby. How's it going?
Many of the logistics are for the benefit of the production, but there are some issues that the residents also need solving.
Okay, so we're here outside one of the main property locations.
It is the main location.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
It's a house at the coast, originally a bed and breakfast. And as you can see here from the vintage motor vehicles, the road at the moment is closed. There's some road surface that makes it period correct.
Yeah.
And the road will now be closed until tomorrow night, just so that they can do exterior scenes, people coming in and out of the property. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the problems that occurred is, of course, that tomorrow morning, unfortunately, people have the bins collected.
Oh,
so
no.
This is another thing that when we do a road closure, we need to organise. So we've agreed with the waste company, the production will move all the waste to the corner and then the waste collector can come and collect them up at a certain time. And we work with the councils as well, because people get upset when their rubbish is not collected for a week and it mounts up in their back garden. So
this film business isn't as glamorous as everyone makes out, is it?
No, it is not. And up there, that's a cherry picker there, where they putting a light in to shine through the windows from the outside, and that will be parked here all week. It's just if the sky goes down, they need some outside light to come in to the windows. And they obviously need a permit, because at the moment you can't see it, but there's double yellow lines under all this road surface covering. So we have to again work with the highway services to suspend the lines and make sure that they've got somewhere to park for the vehicles so that they can shine the lights in.
I don't think people appreciate how many tag vehicles would come with a production.
I know, when you look down there, that's what's 1, 2, 3, 4, 7 or 8 technical trucks and the action vehicles and the cherry picker, and then we're 2 design trucks around there, and then we've got the horse boxes with the spare horses.
It's just enormous.
Yes it is, and that's not even all the 20 trucks on the unit base and the 50 cars and all the rest of it. Yeah, it is quite a big feature film is quite a big deal, and it takes some organising, and I'm always in awe of the location departments sorting it all out, and it is like a military operation, I think.
There's definitely a buzz here down on set though, isn't there?
Yeah, I think it's really exciting and I can't wait to see it. Oh, look, horse and carriage.
Wow.
Sorry, I'm being completely distracted by this wonderful horse and carriage and people in costume walking up and down the beach and riding along the coastal footpath with a big camera crane.
It really does look like, I mean, aside from the camera crane, it really does look like we've stepped back in time a little bit here.
Yes, it does. It's beautiful.
There's just something about it as well, because the grass looks a bit, you know, it's going sort of autumnal. It starts, looks a bit dry. It really does make for an amazing backdrop, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And also because of the way that the shingle banks up there, so you're literally seeing the horse along the beach and the shingle rising up and the blue sea behind with the blue sky. It's lovely.
Kent really is a fantastic backdrop for films to utilise in so many different ways. And it's not just the stunning aesthetic that the region has to offer. Gabrielle explains how the Kent Film Office tries to be as accommodating and helpful as possible to visiting productions.
What's the general feedback from location managers that choose to shoot in Kent?
The main thing is they love the way that we have a fast service, because they're under a lot of pressure, etc., etc., and they want answers fast. And they also know that they can trust me in the sense that, you know, if they're looking for a particular location or for something and I don't have it, I will say straight away, not here. And for them, that's really good, because they can neck check, and they love the fact that they can just phone me up and say, look, I'm looking for that. What do you think? And if I don't have it, I don't try and get them on the off chance. And, you know, or when the other day we've got a big HBO filming in North Kent at the moment, and I had him on the phone the other day, and he said, it's so great when I ask you for stuff, you might only send two things, but then they're the right things. So I think I try, again, with my location manager background, it's nothing worse than getting brochures and suggestions from film officers and you have 30 things and none of it's right. Yeah. I'd rather have one or two options.
Quality over quantity.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's one of the things. And the other thing I think I always hear is that they love the fact of how we support them. So when yesterday I did get a call about these memorial benches, I will make sure it's happening for them. You know, production's happy, they have enough flexibility to change their mind to a certain extent, but on the other hand, the residents get enough notice, it's organized in a way like this. That last minute one, that was one thing. The rest of this has been organized for the last 3 months. So yeah. You can see how calm the set is. You know, nobody's shouting, nobody's running. People are happy to watch, and that's what you want. This is very nice. So thanks, location team, wherever you are. This is very nice.
Well, thank you so much for inviting us down to Dale and Kent, and particularly to taking us on set for this new production, which is going on in the background. Yeah, thank you so much for making the time, Gabrielle. It's been brilliant.
Pleasure.
That's all for now from the seaside town of Deal and from the southeast regions. We'll be back next month with another episode of the podcast as we head north to Manchester. Thank you for listening. I've been your host, Andy Johnson. If you'd like to get in touch about anything you've heard on the podcast or to share your thoughts on the series, we can be found on Twitter at iFeaturesUK. And please do leave us a review and rating on your podcast app. It really helps us to become more discoverable so more people can learn all about film development. Don't forget to subscribe to the series in your podcast app, and then next month's episode will just drop into your feed when it's released. This podcast is brought to you by Creative England, a national body that invests in creative talent and businesses across film, TV, games, and digital media to help turn ideas into reality. iFeatures is led by Creative England and supported by BBC Films, Screen Skills, and made possible through National Lottery funding from the BFI. You can find more information about the programme and this year's 12 selected filmmaking teams on Creative England's website. This series was created and produced by Tonality Media and hosted by me, Andy Johnson.